And both counsel are here for that.
Great.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Shannon Shepherd on behalf of the petitioner, Mir Ali. This is an appeal from a removal proceeding. In removal proceedings, it is the government's burden to prove removability by clear, unequivocal, and convincing evidence. That burden was not met in this case. As you know, Mr. Ali entered the United States on an H-1B visa. In 2000, Congress passed the American Competitiveness in the 21st Century Act, or what we call AC-21. AC-21 allowed for H-1B visa holders to transfer jobs upon filing of a new petition if they wanted to change employers. So in other words, as soon as that petition was filed, they could transfer to the new employer without waiting the sometimes months that it takes for the Immigration Service to catch up and adjudicate the petition. This policy benefits both the employers and the foreign nationals and allows for a freer flow of in the workplace. AC-21 requires that an alien enter in lawful status, that the petition filed by the new employer is not frivolous, and that the alien has not worked without authorization since his or her admission. In this case, we know the first two prongs of that test were met. Mr. Ali entered lawfully, and the petition was not frivolous. In fact, it was later granted by the service. The issue in front of the immigration judge was whether or not Mr. Ali had worked without authorization for the new employer prior to the filing of the petition. And the issue before this court is whether the Board of Immigration Appeals and the immigration court below erred in relying on the Form I-213, which is the Record of Deportable Alien. In this case, that I-13 form was unsubstantiated and unreliable. Now, an I-213 is generally accepted as admissible evidence in immigration proceedings. But when there are glaring inaccuracies on that form, then its reliability must be called into question.
Let me ask you something, please, Ms. Shepherd.
Yes.
It seems that the only relevant information that the I-213 needs to convey is that Mr. Ali worked at T&L Foods prior to June 27, 2002, when he was authorized to do so. So I'm not completely certain as to how the transposing of a 2 to a 0 increases the unreliability of the document as to any relevant matter, as to anything that's really relevant.
Well, Your Honor, there's several issues with the 213, with the dates on the 213. First, if the agent who was interviewing Mr. Ali didn't get the year right, who's to say that he got the month right as well? So the government tried to rectify that by calling the agent in to testify in court. However, when the agent came to testify in court, he stated he was merely basing his testimony on the 213. He didn't offer any independent evidence. He didn't offer any corroborating evidence or supplemental evidence to prove that Mr. Ali had been working since March 2002. Additionally, even argumentatively, if Mr. Ali was working for the petitioner prior to June 27th, this still could cause problems for him in the future. For example...
Yeah, but forgive me. I mean, am I wrong when I seem to think that Mr. Ali would have been working illegally whether he began in March 2000 or March 2002. In other words, the only relevant information is whether he'd been working for T&L prior to June 27th, 2002, when he became authorized to do so.
Yes, but there was nothing to corroborate or substantiate the government's allegation that he had been working in March of any year for T&L Foods other than this I-213, whose reliability was then called into question. As I mentioned earlier, the month could have been wrong as well. And it would have been theoretically simple for the government to come up with additional evidence to substantiate their claims, such as employment records, testimony from the employer, or calling in the USDA agents who allegedly saw Mr. Ali working at some other time other than August 20th of 2002.
Is it your position that any inaccurate information in the 213 dooms the entire document as unreliable? Like as if, let's say this form had stated somewhere that he'd been working at T&K Foods as opposed to T&L Foods. Is it any inaccurate information?
Well, Your Honor, any inaccurate information that the government then can't substantiate independently makes the 213 unreliable. I mean, in many fields, a typo is an innocent and harmless error, but in immigration, a typo can have someone ordered removed from the country. I think the consequences in this case are much more severe than your average problem with a typo.
Well, what about the document from the former employer? Was it Everett or whatever?
Everest,
yeah, consulting. They said something about he worked there ending or as of something about May 15th.
Yes, the letter that was provided stated that as of the date of that letter, which was May 15th, 2002, Mr. Ali was working for Everest Food, the original petitioner.
So you have a conflict there, at least, based on whatever he said or somebody said he said is working for the T&L as of April.
Yes.
Unless he worked for both of them at the same time.
It contradicts the 213 as well.
Well, isn't it possible that he was working at both places? Like many hardworking immigrants do, they have more than one job.
There's nothing in the record, though, that substantiates where he was working, and that's the issue, is that the government is required to provide clear, convincing, substantial evidence in removability cases. And in this case, they just didn't meet that burden. As I said, the 213 was unreliable and inconsistent on its face, and the officer didn't have any independent knowledge of the facts, nor did the government call in anyone else who might have had independent knowledge of the allegations on the 213. And the letter that you just mentioned, Your Honor, also was basically ignored by the immigration court, and the Board of Immigration Appeals then said that it was not explained, or, you know, the contents of its origin wasn't explained, which you know, doesn't make it unreliable in this case. It's a clearly contradictory piece of evidence that, you know, could have shed some light on when and where Mr. Ali was working. And in this case, the government did not do anything. The government agent who testified didn't do anything other than parrot or mimic the contents of the 213. There was nothing to supplement or strengthen those allegations in this case.
Well, this is frustrating from everybody's point of view, because obviously if all these things were false, it would have been real easy to show otherwise, even though it is the government's proof. So this guy was a hard worker. He obviously was trying to do everything right. He may have worked somewhere else, the other job, sooner than he should have, but he was continuing along. We have a lot more serious problems than this one. But nevertheless, we're looking at the strict letter of the law. And we've got a problem here from what that they found. It's clear and convincing when someone says, and he said to someone else, that's where the testimony is. That's sort of a problem. Yeah, being honest, maybe. That's where I worked. And then I got, I'm still working there, and I'm authorized to work there, or soon will be.
Well, again, on the date of the arrest, he admitted that he was working there, but there was nothing other than the 213 to indicate what date Mr. Ali said that he had
started.
What
he said,
You know, the government has a huge upper hand in these removal proceedings with the 213. It's generally considered reliable and admissible, as we stated before, but because they have such an upper hand, they should be expected to prepare these forms correctly and accurately. And if you don't mind, I'd like to save some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Shepherd.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Tom Dupree on behalf of the United States. The Board's determination that Mr. Ali began work at T&L Foods in March of 2002 is a factual determination that is reviewed deferentially by this Court. Only if this Court determines that the evidence compels a contrary conclusion may it reverse. And we would submit that in this case, the Board's determination that Mr. Ali commenced work in March of 2002 was a reasonable conclusion and one that was amply supported by the evidence.
Would it have made any difference if he was working at T&L Foods without compensation?
Well, Judge Rovner, the statute does refer to working either for money or for other compensation. So I do think that if it turns out that Mr. Ali was volunteering at T&L Foods, that in that circumstance, arguably he would not be in violation. I think the statute does require him to have worked for compensation, either in money or in kind.
And what does the record tell us?
Well, the record tells us that Mr. Ali said to the agent that he was working at T&L Foods. And I certainly think it is a reasonable inference that he would not be volunteering his services. The record reflects that this was a food store where he had been working behind the counter. And again, I think it would certainly be a reasonable inference to assume that he was either being paid for his work, particularly the way that Mr. Ali described it is that he was working 40 hours a week. Again, I think it's reasonable to conclude either that he was being paid for that or otherwise compensated in kind. Mr. Ali, although he certainly wasn't required to testify, and while the government certainly bore the burden of establishing removability, chose not to testify at his removal hearing and say, here's when I started work at T&L Foods, deny that he said what the agent claims he said. He didn't say any of that. The petitioner's argument is simply that the government didn't carry its burden in this case. I think the question earlier from Judge Rovner that really concerned the materiality of the typo, I think is exactly right. Regardless of whether the petitioner began working in March of 2000 or March of 2002, under either circumstance, it was unauthorized work. So I do think that this case is analogous to one in which the agent, for example, puts down an erroneous middle initial when signing his name. I think the fact that there's a typographical error that wouldn't make a difference in the outcome doesn't warrant jettisoning the entire 213 or deeming the agent's testimony in whole per se unreliable. In fact, this court's decision in the Rosendo Ramirez case, I think, suggests the opposite conclusion. In that case, this court described the I-213 as carelessly drafted and so sloppy as to raise eyebrows. And yet, despite those deficiencies, this court nonetheless held that it was sufficiently reliable. I think in this case, first of all, it's entirely clear that the 2000 date was a typographical error. The agent explained exactly what happened when he just hit the wrong key as he was typing it in. In several other places on the 213, up at the top right-hand corner, he got the date right. Down in the narrative, he got the date right again. He concurrently filed a notice to appear where he got the date correct again. So he repeatedly typed in March 2002, except for this one instance where he happened to type in March 2000. I think his explanation that this was a legitimate typographical error was entirely reasonable, and I think the board and the IJ were properly entitled to credit it. The petitioner argues that the I-213 was the entirety of the government's proof in this case, and I don't think that's exactly right. I would call the court's attention to page 83 of the administrative record, where the government actually called the agent to the removal hearing, put him on. He testified as to what he saw that day, as to what he did. He was subjected to cross-examination. And the agent was asked the following question: to obtain the information on this documentation, did you have occasion to question the respondent? Answer: yes, I did. And the agent goes on to say, page 83, Mr. Ali admitted that he was working at T&L Foods for approximately 40 hours a week beginning in March of 2002. Later on, page 84 of the record, questioning the agent again. Question, this March 2000 date, where you say that he claimed he had been working there since that March 2000 date, where did you obtain that date? Answer, that was from him. Question, he told you that? Answer, yes. The petitioner's argument is that the agent later went on to testify that his recollection was based entirely on the form and that he had no independent recollection of these events other than what was reflected in the form. And for one thing, I think the testimony I just quoted undercuts that argument. And the petitioner's claim is based on an exchange that occurred later on where the petitioner's lawyer said, but you know definitely something that happened 2 years ago. And the agent referred, he said, yes, based on what my notes say. And then the petitioner's lawyer said, but you don't know for sure. And the agent says, I know that my notes say that, and that's what I'm basing it on. So I think what the agent was saying is that he recollects what happened that day. He talked at length about things that occurred that are not reflected in the 213. So he clearly had an independent recollection. And then when the petitioner's lawyer pressed him on that and said, well, how can you be definitely sure about that? How can you know all of that? At that point, he said, well, I'm basing that on my notes. That's how I know that I can be sure. The petitioner also cites, and this gets to Judge Mannion's question about the letter from his employer, or his original employer, Everest Consulting. I think there are 2 points worth making on this issue. The first is that petitioner waived any argument based on the Everest letter, and that's because the petitioner did not make this argument in his brief to the board. His brief to the board focused solely on the sufficiency of the I-213 and did not argue, as I think they attempt to do before this court, that the Everest letter compels a different result. The petitioner's brief to the board is reproduced at page 13 of the administrative record, and because that argument was not raised before the board, he has not exhausted it, and this court accordingly lacks jurisdiction to consider it. Even if somehow this court were to overlook that waiver, I still don't think that letter carries the day for petitioner. And that's because this is a classic case where you have a he said, she said situation. You have the investigating agent saying, he told me March 2002, and you have this letter, which we'll accept for purposes of argument, contradicts what the agent said. I think the board was perfectly entitled to credit the agent's testimony over this letter. If you have conflicting facts, it's obviously the role of the trier of fact to resolve those conflicts. I certainly think the board's determination that the agent's testimony and the agent's documentation was more credible than this letter, that was certainly a reasonable conclusion. I think this court plainly can and should uphold it under the substantial evidence standard. The last point is the petitioner alleges that there was a regulatory violation committed by the agency and that the arresting officer was also the officer who completed the 213 form. 2 points on this. Number one, here too, the petitioner waived it. Petitioner's brief to the board, AR-13, says nothing about the alleged violation of this regulation, so that claim has not been exhausted and is not properly before this court. Second, even if this court were to overlook the waiver, this court's decision in the Martinez-Camargo case is directly on point. In that case, this court held that even assuming the violation of a regulation, the petitioner still needs to prove prejudice. In this case, the petitioner plainly cannot establish prejudice, and for that reason as well, the petition for review should be denied.
You may be correct about waiver of the HCFR 287.3, but you might also want to go back and take a look at the government's brief, because the government used an ellipsis to omit the key words of the regulation. It concludes the regulation did not apply because Ali had been arrested pursuant to a warrant. But in the brief, in reciting the regulation to this court, the key words of arrest were omitted, and an ellipsis was used. And to my knowledge, the government did not, in fact, have an arrest warrant for Ali, did it?
Judge Rovner, I think you're exactly right, and when I read the government's brief, I too noted that, and that's exactly why I didn't press that argument before the court today, and I'm not making it now.
Okay. All right. Is that it, Mr. Dupree?
That is all, unless there are further questions from the panel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Shepherd, how much time does Ms. Shepherd have?
1 minute.
Thank you.
Just a few quick points, Your Honors. The case here, it's more than just an issue of a factual determination. It's an issue of whether or not the government met its burden of proof. And in this case, they simply did not. The agent who arrested Mr. Ali stated that he never personally observed him working at T&L Foods, that his testimony was based on the I-213 rather than any independent recollection of the details, which I believe is what he was saying in the quote that counsel just read. Affirmative proof that Mr. Ali was working for compensation for T&L Foods at any time was never offered by the government. And it is the government's burden in these cases to prove removability by clear, convincing, and unequivocal evidence. The typos in this case are significant, and they are more than just mere harmless errors. They could affect Mr. Ali's future ability to return to the United States, even if he is forced to depart at this time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shepherd. Thanks to Ms. Shepherd. Thanks to Mr. Dupree, and the case will be taken under advisement. Now, have we got our counsel from the third case?
We do.
Great. 073.